Whomever you are, wherever you come from, whomever you love, we welcome you. I am Joel Slater, today's worship leader. Lay-led services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe that the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. We are glad to have you with us this morning. We hope you find something in the service today that nourishes your spirit and helps you find and keep your balance. We light this chalice in memory of those who have been persistent seekers, those whose desire to search together gave us this church, whose search for truth shaped this questing religion, whose perspectives on freedom created more justice amongst peoples. On this day, we light this chalice in memory of an exemplary seeker, Charles Robert Darwin. Our presence here this morning is lit by his and all seekers and all seekers' dreams and deeds.
Our opening music this morning is a song inspired by Darwin. It's called "It's a Long Way from Amphioxus." So according to Mr. Darwin, this is a song about one of our ancestors, a tribute of one of our ancestors.
This was the first song I sang in this church with anybody. Actually, the first song I sang in this church around January 1998. And it may be the last.
A fish-like thing appeared among the annelids one day. It hadn't any pteropods or cetas to display. It hadn't any eyes or jaws or ventral nervous cord.
Oh, no.
But it had a lot of gill slits, and it had a notochord. It's a long way from Amphioxus. It's a long way to us. It's a long way from Amphioxus to the meanest human cuss. Goodbye, fins and gill slits. Hello, lungs and hair. It's a long, long way from Amphioxus, but we come from there. It wasn't much to look at, and it scarce knew how to swim. And Nurse wasn't very sure it didn't come from him. The mollusk wouldn't own it, and the arthropods got sore. So the poor thing had to burrow in the sand along the shore. It wiggled in the sand before a crab could nip its tail.
Ouch.
It said gill slits and myotomes are all of no avail.
Oh, good to me.
I've grown some metapleural folds and sport an oral hood. But all these fine new characters don't do me any good. Help us out. It's a long way from Amphioxus. It's a long way to us. It's a long way from Amphioxus to the meanest human cuss. Goodbye, fins and gill slits. Hello, lungs and it's a long, long way from Amphioxus, but we come from there. It sulked a while down in the sand without a bit of pep, then stiffened up its notochord and said, I'll beat 'em yet.
Rah, rah, rah.
I've got more possibilities within my slender frame. than all these proud invertebrates that treat me with such shame.
Yeah, so take that.
My no-do cord shall grow into a chain of vertebrae.
I got a backbone.
As fins my metapleural folds shall agitate the sea. My tiny dorsal nervous tube shall form a mighty brain.
I'm a genius too.
And the vertebrate shall dominate the animal domain. And it's a long way from Amphioxus. It's a long way to us. It's a long way from Amphioxus to the meanest human cuss. Goodbye, fins and gill slits. Hello, lungs and hair. It's a long, long way from Amphioxus, but we come from there.
Our guest today is Mr. Charles Darwin, illustrious grandson of both Mr. Erasmus Darwin and Mr. Josiah Wedgwood. Mr. Darwin has published several popular works, among them The Voyages of the Beagle, The Structure and Distribution of Coral Reefs, The Origin of Species, The Descent of Man, Orchids, Insectivorous Plants, Selection in Relation to Sex, and many others. His books have been translated into many languages. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of London and the recipient of numerous awards and citations. For all that, he lives a quiet life at Down House in Kent with his wife and children.
You'll excuse my sitting. It's been a bad year. Thank you for that generous introduction. I do not cease to wonder at the extent to which my little books have been read around the world. A German editor wrote to me to ask for an account of the development of my mind and character with some sketch of my autobiography. I have thought that the attempt would amuse me and might possibly interest my children. Let me share a bit of that account. I was born at Shrewsbury in February 12, 1809, within but a few hours of the birth of your President Lincoln. My mother died in July 1817, when I was a little over 8 years old, and it is odd that I can hardly remember anything about her. In the spring of that same year, I was sent to a day school in Shrewsbury, where I stayed a year before going to Dr. Butler's great school, where I stayed 7 years. I have been told that I was much slower in learning than my younger sister, Catherine, and I believe that I was in many ways a naughty boy. I'm sure you've heard that my mother was a Unitarian, and she attended the Reverend G. Case's Chapel in High Street, Shrewsbury, and it was at Reverend Case's school where we all began. By the time I went to this day school, my taste for natural history, and more especially for collecting, was well developed. I tried to make out the names of plants and collected all sorts of things: shells, seals, stamps, coins, minerals. The passion for collecting, which leads a man to be a systematic naturalist, a virtuoso, or a miser, was very strong in me.
Nothing could have been worse for the development of my mind than Dr. Butler's school, as it was strictly classical, nothing else being taught except a little ancient geography and history. When I left that school, I believe that I was considered by all my masters and my father as a very ordinary boy, rather below the common standard in intellect. To my deep mortification, my father once said to me, "You care for nothing but shooting, dogs, and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family." Well, as I was doing no good at school, my father wisely took me away at a rather earlier age than usual and sent me to Edinburgh University with my brother, where I stayed for 2 years. I was but 16. My brother was completing his medical studies, and I was sent there to commence them. But after having spent 2 sessions in Edinburgh, my father perceived that I did not like the thought of being a physician, so he proposed that I should become a clergyman. Considering how fiercely I have been attacked by the Orthodox, it seems ludicrous that I once intended to be a clergyman. Nor was this intention and my father's wish ever formally given up, but died a natural death when, on leaving Cambridge, I joined the Beagle as naturalist. During the 3 years which I spent at Cambridge, my time was wasted as far as the academical studies were concerned, as completely as at Edinburgh and at school. No pursuit at Cambridge was followed with nearly so much eagerness or gave me so much pleasure as collecting beetles. I will give a proof of my zeal. One day, on tearing off some old bark, I saw 2 rare beetles and seized one in each hand. Then I saw a third and a new kind, which I could not bear to lose, so that I popped the one which I held in my right hand into my mouth. Ah! It ejected some intensely acrid fluid which burnt my tongue, so that I was forced to spit that beetle out, which was lost, as was the third one. The voyage of the Beagle has been by far the most important event in my life and has determined my whole career. I have always felt that I owe the voyage the first real training or education of my mind. I was led to attend closely to several branches of natural history, and thus my powers of observation were improved. I was as a child presented with all the wonders of the world spread before me. The glories of the vegetation of the tropics rise before my mind more vivid than almost anything else. The great deserts of Patagonia and the forest-clad mountains of Tierra del Fuego have left an indelible impression on my mind. Many of my excursions on horseback through wild countries, some of which lasted several weeks, were deeply interesting. Their discomfort and some degree of danger were hardly a drawback. I also reflect with high satisfaction on some of my scientific work. I cannot pass over the discovery of the singular relation of the animals and plants inhabiting the several islands of the Galapagos Archipelago, and all of them to the inhabitants of South America. I worked to the utmost during the voyage from the mere pleasure of investigation, and from my strong desire to add a few facts to the great mass of facts in natural science. My collection of fossil bones, which had been sent to Henslow, excited considerable attention amongst paleontologists. After reading his letter, I clambered over the mountains of Ascension with a bounding step and made the volcanic rocks resound under my hammer. During the 2 years after my return from the voyage, I was led to think much about religion. Whilst on board the Beagle, I was quite orthodox. And I remember being heartily laughed at by several of the officers for quoting the Bible as an unanswerable authority on some point of morality. I suppose it was the novelty of the argument that amused them. But I have gradually come to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, etc., etc., and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. by further reflecting that the clearest evidence would be requisite to make any sane man believe in the miracles by which Christianity is supported, and that the more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become. I gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity as a divine revelation. Beautiful as is the morality of the New Testament, it can be hardly denied that its perfection depends in part on the interpretation which we now put on metaphors and allegories. Disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but it was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress, and have never since doubted even for a single second that my conclusion was correct. I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true. For if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, my brother, almost all of my friends, would be everlastingly punished. And this is a damnable doctrine. I own that I cannot see, as plainly as others do, and as I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to me too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have created ichneumon wasps with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice. Not believing this, I see no necessity in the belief that the eye was expressly designed. There seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course which the wind blows. Everything in nature is a result of fixed laws. I cannot pretend to throw the least light on such abstruse problems. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain what my friend Thomas Huxley calls an agnostic. For myself, I believe that I have acted rightly in steadily following and devoting my life to science. I feel no remorse for having committed any great sin, but have often and often regretted that I have not done more direct good to my fellow creatures. Long have my wife Emma and I discussed belief, faith, and doubt, and she does her Unitarian Wedgwood family proud from the strength of her conviction and argument. I remember my son Francis' story of her taking the children into church and making the family rise and turn around in silence to face the congregation when they all stood to recite the Trinitarian Creed. Notwithstanding, it is remarkable how some of the ideas she holds intuitively from her faith I have found to hold true in nature. That all humanity is derived from a common origin cannot now be doubted, and likely all life on this world has sprung from a single seed. Should we then not hold all creatures more dearly, as cousins, no matter how distant? And are not all the tribes and bands of men yet our brothers? Emma has been my greatest blessing. And I can declare that in my whole life I have never heard her utter one word which I had rather been left unsaid. She has never failed in the kindest sympathy toward me, and has borne with the utmost patience my frequent complaints from ill health and discomfort. I do not believe she has ever missed an opportunity of doing a kind action to anyone near her. She has been my wise advisor and cheerful comforter throughout life. She has earned the love and admiration of every soul near her. When all or most of our children are at home, no party can be, according to my taste, more agreeable. We have suffered only one very severe grief in the death of Annie at Malvern on April 24th, 1851. When she was just over 10 years old. She was a most sweet and affectionate child. I feel sure she would have grown into a delightful woman. Tears come into my eyes when I think of her sweet ways. I'm sorry. My illness has come upon me again. I must rest a while. Excuse me. I must have told you this story before, but let me read you a bit from my travel journal. April 4th to July 5th, 1832. A few days after our arrival in Rio de Janeiro, I became acquainted with an Englishman who was going to visit his estate, somewhat to the northward of Cape Frio. I gladly accepted his kind offer of allowing me to accompany him. The day was powerfully hot, and as we passed through the woods, everything was motionless, excepting the large and brilliant butterflies which lazily fluttered about. The view seen when crossing the hills behind Praia Grande was most beautiful. The colors were intense, and the prevailing tint a dark blue. The sky and the calm waters of the bay vied with each other in splendor. We entered a forest, which in the grandeur of all its parts could not be exceeded. As it was growing dark, we passed under one of the massive, bare, and steep hills of granite which are so common in this country. This spot is notorious for having been, for a long time, the residence of some runaway slaves, who, by cultivating a little ground near the top, contrived to eke out a subsistence. At length they were discovered, and a party of soldiers being sent, the whole were seized, with the exception of one old woman, who sooner than again be led into slavery, dashed herself to pieces from the summit of the mountain. In a Roman matron, this would have been called the noble love of freedom. In a poor negress, it was mere brutal obstinacy. My family, the Darwins and the Wedgwoods, were long involved in the movement to abolish slavery in Britain. In the late 1700s, the Lunar Society met in Birmingham on moonlit nights, the better to see their way home again after. These lunatics were eminent men, 9 of the 12 being members of the Royal Society. It was at these meetings that Joseph Priestley, Erasmus Darwin, and Josiah Wedgwood met and grew close. They were industrialists, most of them, and angered that from those Birmingham factories came cheap firearms, powder, ammunition, and iron, which went into the slave trade operating out of Liverpool. My father married Susanna, one of the Wedgwood daughters. Grandfather Josiah was a patriotic man and hoped Britain's abolition of slavery would compensate for the loss of the American colonies. The movement found much support from the prophets of the Wedgwood potteries in Etruria. My Emma was Uncle Joe's youngest daughter. We nearly grew up together. I practically learned to read from abolitionist pamphlets. There were so many of them in the house. And dinner conversation continued to revolve around the movement for years to follow. Whilst slavery was abolished in Britain's dominions in 1807, it wasn't eliminated in the colonies until 1833. Yet during this time, there were enough free Negroes in Britain for it to be clear to many that we are all netted together. We all feel a common pain. Planters in Jamaica held Negroes to be a separate species of man and claimed that intermarriage between the races produced nothing but sterile hybrids, which is patent nonsense. Your Professor Silliman, a geologist at Yale in those days, once wrote with amazement, "It would seem that the prejudice against color is less strong in England than in America, for the few Negroes found in this country are in a condition much superior to that of their countrymen found anywhere else. An ill-dressed or starving Negro is never seen in England. A few days since, I met in Oxford Street a well-dressed white girl who was of a ruddy complexion and even handsome, walking arm in arm and conversing very sociably with a Negro man, as well-dressed as she, and so black that his skin had a kind of ebony luster." The professor seems absolutely shocked. "Whilst I was at Edinburgh, John Edmonstone, a Negro, lived there, who had traveled with Waterton and gained his livelihood stuffing birds, which he did excellently. He gave me lessons for payment, and I used to often sit with him, for he was a pleasant and most intelligent man. We all believed such people were little different from us, despite the appearances, and even the rudest savages were more the product of their conditions than that they were separately created from Englishmen. Well, as you know, I was saved from a lifetime listening to the petty concerns of a quiet country parish by being put forward as a suitable companion for the captain of the Beagle in 1831. I dare say I've told you Fitzroy's temper was a most unfortunate one. He was extremely kind to me, but was a man very difficult to live with on intimate terms. We had several quarrels, for when out of temper, he was utterly unreasonable. For instance, early in the voyage at Bahia in Brazil, he defended and praised slavery and told me that he had just visited a great slave owner who had called up many of his slaves and asked them whether they were happy and whether they wished to be free, and they all answered no. I then asked him, perhaps with a sneer, whether he thought that the answers of slaves in the presence of their master was worth anything. This made him excessively angry, and he said that as I doubted his word, we could not live any longer together. I thought that I should have been compelled to leave the ship, but after a few hours, Fitzroy sent an officer to me with an apology. On the 19th of August, we finally left the shores of Brazil. I thank God I shall never visit again a slave country. To this day, if I hear a distant scream, it recalls with painful vividness my feelings when, passing a house near Pernambuco, I heard the most pitiable moans and knew that I was as powerless as a child even to remonstrate. I have stayed in a house where a young household mulatto, daily and hourly, was reviled, beaten, persecuted enough to break the spirit of the lowest animal. I have seen a little boy, 6 or 7 years old, struck thrice with a horsewhip on his naked head for having handed me a glass of water not quite clean. I saw his father tremble at a mere glance from his master's eye. I will not even allude to the many heart-sickening atrocities which I authentically heard of, nor would I have mentioned the above revolting details had I not met with several people so blinded as to speak of slavery as a tolerable evil. What a cheerless prospect, with not even a hope of change. Picture to yourself the chance of ever hanging over you, of your wife and your little children being torn from you and sold like beasts to the highest bidder. And these deeds are done and palliated by men who profess to love their neighbors as themselves, who believe in God and pray that his will be done on earth. It makes one's blood boil, yet heart tremble, to think that we Englishmen, and you our American descendants, with your boastful cry of liberty, have been so guilty. Ah, but here, Asa Gray writes to me from Harvard. My dear Darwin, your book has reached me, and it is crammed full of most interesting matter, thoroughly digested, well expressed. Taken as a system, it makes out a better case than I had supposed possible. It will excite much attention here and with some controversy. Dr. Louis Agassiz, when I saw him last, had read but a part of it. He says it is poor. The fact is, he growls over it like a well-cudgeled dog and is very annoyed by it, to our great delight. He says, and I quote, "I consider the transmutation theory a scientific mistake, untrue in facts, unscientific in its methods, and mischievous in its tendency. What has the whale in the Arctic regions to do with the lion or the tiger in the tropical Indies? Whenever we study the general relations of animals, we study more than the affinities of beasts. We study the manner in which it has pleased the Creator to express his thoughts in living realities. There lies really the moral value of the study of nature." Instead of learning caution from experience, Agassiz goes on faster than ever, confident that he reads nature through and through, and without the least apparent misgiving that anything will turn up that he cannot explain away. The good professor has been helping the circulation of your book by denouncing it as atheistical. It's hard to please everyone. The best part, I think, is the whole. That is, its plan and treatment. The vast amount of facts and acute inferences handled as if you had a perfect mastery of them. I am free to say that I never learned so much from one book as I have from yours. My review for the American Journal of Science will state, "The theory of Agassiz regards the origin of species and their present general distribution over the world as equally primordial, equally supernatural, that of Darwin as equally derivative, equally natural." Surely the scientific mind of an age which contemplates the solar system as evolved from a common revolving fluid mass cannot be expected to let the old belief about species pass unquestioned. We cling to a long accepted theory, just as we cling to an old suit of clothes. A new theory, like a new pair of breeches, is sure to have hard-fitting places. I should rather think that there was a good chance of my becoming the most egotistical man in all Europe. Ah, but then Gray changes the subject. You know we are engaged in a war, upon the determination of which our very existence depends. All reason and right and patience appears to be on one side, all madness, audacity, and folly on the other. Our former feeble administration was helpless in the hands of hoodwinking traitors and thieves. But Lincoln is a Trump, a second Washington. Steady, conservative, no fanatical abolitionist. You may expect to hear of stirring times here. Of all of my English correspondents, you are the only one touching upon our relations with the South and with England, whose views and sentiments are perfectly satisfactory to me. And my wife takes a stronger line and bids me send her love to Mr. Darwin and say that he is the only Englishman whose letters do not give her a shock to read. That you should think it beyond our power to subdue the rebels is very natural. We do not doubt that we can, and you will also see that we do not mean that anything else shall stand in the way of it. If we do not do it, we shall have to eat much dirt. God help us indeed. As to slavery, the course of things is getting to meet your views, as it is clear must be if the South continue obstinate. Such resistance will surely bring on wide-sweeping manumission. Ever yours cordially, Asa Gray, 1861. Come, Francis, please take down my reply for Gray. My very dear Gray, your article will greatly mollify opposition to my book. I can now plainly see that I should have been fairly annihilated had it not been for four or five men, including yourself. The effect on me is that I will buckle on my armor and fight my best. By myself, I should be powerless, and I thank you very much. It is now 6 months since I have done a stroke of work. I, of course, seen no one, and since good dear Hooker, I hear from no one. The vomiting is not now daily, and on my good days I am much stronger. My head hardly now troubles me, except singing in the ears. What I shall soon have to do will be to erect a tablet in Down Church, sacred to the memory, etc., and officially die, and then publish books by the late Charles Darwin. I'm sending a photograph of myself with my beard. Do I not look venerable? We are profoundly interested by your politics and do not in the least know whether the old bloody times of London is to be trusted, that there will be peace, and that the middle states will join with the South on slavery and eject the northern states. In the latter case, I hope you will marry Canada and divorce England and make a grand country counterbalancing the devilish South. I wonder whether the queries I've received from America about the specific distinctions of the races of man are a reflection of Agassiz's lectures in the U.S., in which he has been maintaining that doctrine of several species, much, I dare say, to the comfort of those slaveholders. How very singular it is that so eminently clever a man, with such immense knowledge, should write such wonderful stuff and bosh as he does. Lyle told me that he was so delighted with one of Agassiz's lectures on progressive development, etc., etc., that he went to him afterwards and told him it was so delightful that he could not help all the time wishing it were true. I finished my book on the descent of man, etc., before my recent illness, and its publication is being delayed only by the index. When published, I will send you a copy, but I do not know that you will care for it. Parts will, I dare say, aggravate you. Pray, give our very kind remembrances to Mrs. Gray. I know that she likes to hear men boasting. It refreshes them so much. Now, the tally with my wife in backgammon stands thus. She, poor creature, has won only 2,490 games, whilst I have won, hurrah, hurrah, 2,795 games. Gray, I have been a most ungrateful and ungracious man not to have written you an immense time ago to thank you heartily for all your most kind aid. Believe me, my dear Gray, your ungrateful but most sincere friend, Charles Darwin. Thank you, Francis. Please put that in the Morning Post, and don't forget the photograph. You know, I began my work with the most conventional of educations and ready to accept the words of my teachers uncritically. But I was granted the opportunity to travel the world as a young man, and I was not then so fossilized as you see me today. Just as my brother Gass and I would experiment just for the pleasure of finding things out, I marveled as a child would at the rocks, fossils, animals, and people I encountered on my journey. And I saw that those learned men of my textbooks were wrong in so many ways. If I have seen more than Agassiz, perhaps it was because I have always been sympathetic to our common fate, our common heritage. Those who looked for science to prove their exalted status, to lord over their fellow men, not to mention the apes and lesser forms of life, were not open to seeing the connected links which bind us all in one family. We are all netted together. We feel a common pain, and we have more in common than that which separates us. The most dangerous thoughts are those we most want to be true, and we would be wise to confirm them before too rashly jumping to conclusions. Nature will tell you her story, but you must listen to learn it. Although our viscera has its analog in the ape or monkey, and our emotions and the expression of the same can be seen on the faces of all those our kin, the human brain is a thing of wondrous subtlety. Where lesser animals must depend on instinct, we have the ability to reason, and so rise above the common prejudices of instinct or those we learned in our childhood. Indeed, we must, if we are to live on this planet without war or famine or neglect to devastate great numbers of us. Your Mr. Lincoln, if he is victorious, will find that the task of repairing the divisions of race has only just begun. But I have every hope you will succeed. I'll conclude with what I said at the end of The Origin of Species. As all the living forms of life are the lineal descendants of those which lived long before the Cambrian epoch, we may feel certain that the ordinary succession by generation has never once been broken, and that no cataclysm has desolated the whole world. There is a grandeur in this view of life. From so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved.
Thank you, Mr. Darwin, for joining us from faraway Kent and coming all the way to Kent. We will conclude with the closing words written from Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery.